take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your having great merch helps too, of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Garamonica.
From the ages 1 to 4, around the age of 5, you shipped away for your body to be stored. They promise education, but really they give you testing scores. And they predict in prison population by who's scoring the lowest. And usually the lowest scores, the poorest, and they look like me. And every day on the evening news, they feed your fear for free. And you so numb, you watch the cops choke out a man like me. Until my voice goes,
there hasn't been a whole lot of music that has arisen from this particular political and social moment that's felt completely poignant. You know, we talked about Lil Baby a couple weeks ago, who kind of had that perfect intersection of genuine popularity and also speaking to the current moment. There's also plenty of other songs that have been released that on a smaller scale have been really effective. But there was something specific about the most recent Run the Jewels record, which came out a month ago, where it felt like it arrived at almost like a, you know, I don't believe in things like this, but almost kind of like a preordained moment. Obviously, the record had been done for a while before it came out. It had been recorded in a different moment. But in listening to RTJ4 and in going back into the Run the Jewels catalog, what's very clear is that the America that everybody is very clearly living in now and actually has been living in for quite some time, even if their eyes have been a little bit covered to it. This is the America that Run the Jewels have been rapping about and making music about for years now. This is a group that remains skeptical of government institutions, concerned with police violence. This is a group made of people who are angry, frustrated, and effective. And Run the Jewels 4 is maybe the best distillation of that while connecting broader social and systemic narratives to personal revelations. And we haven't really talked about Run the Jewels on podcast. I don't think we have, at least. And so I wanted to try to take a long view of how we arrived at a moment where Run the Jewels, LP, Killer Mike, two middle-aged rappers, have made the record that feels like it's close to a soundtrack of the current political moment as anybody. At the beginning of the episode, we were listening to Walking in the Snow. That's off RTJ4. This is one of many great Killer Mike verses on this album, and really does the work of connecting personal narratives to kind of global systemic concerns. And this is something that comes up a lot and we're going to talk about on this week's episode. So in order to kind of talk about Run the Jewels and the whole history of how we arrived at this moment, I wanted to bring in somebody who has been paying attention from the very beginning and written very sharply and acutely about this group. No stranger to Popcast, Sheldon Pierce is here. Sheldon, what's really good? How are you, man?
Yes. Recurring guest now, I can officially say. I feel like a cast member.
That's right. Put it on your resume. Put it on your Twitter bio. That's right.
thank you for having me. I am happy to be back.
So first of all, Sheldon, before we get into the jewels, the gun and the fist, two things. One, I do want to say up front, I had a challenging week with scheduling last week, and you were nothing but decent and kind about the many scheduling changes. So thank you for that. I want to just say that publicly. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm humbled. Thank you.
It's very true. Not everybody would be so gracious. The second thing is, before we get to Run the Jewels, you have an announcement, or you've already announced, but you have a thing that you're working on. you're working on a book. You want to just tell the people quickly what's coming.
Yes. Next year, to commemorate the 50th birthday of Tupac Shakur, I am releasing an oral history through Simon & Schuster. I'm really excited about it. It has been a blast to work on so far, and I can't wait for people to read it.
And it's of his whole life?
His whole life. We are going through interviewing just about anybody we can find who is willing to talk about their relationship to him, share stories, not just about his life and his art, but also about his impact. Because, I mean, as we're seeing now, he still remains a vital figure to moments like these.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and so it feels not just because of these anniversaries that come up. Also, next year is the 25th anniversary of his death. But I've just been seeing interviews from him pop up everywhere, hearing his music everywhere, and his messages still seem so vital to moments like these. So it just feels like a great time to sort of speak about his broader impact.
Look, whatever book you're working on, we would have talked about it, but I'm glad it's about Pac, because I do think not only is Pac relevant in this particular cultural and social moment, but the way that Pac was relevant in his cultural and social moment has some parallels to the way Run the Jewels and specifically Killer Mike is so poignant in this moment. So there is a thread that bridges your two projects, or at least your main project and your project here for the next 45 minutes here.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about your history with Run the Jewels before you wrote this review. You put the review, it's an 8.3, it's a best new music, but tell me what you came in the door with, because I want to eventually get to what I came in the door with, because I feel like it's confessional mode time. So tell me what you came in the door with vis-a-vis LP and Killer Mike.
Yeah, so I first got into LP through Fantastic Damage, just the early Def Jux stuff or pre-Def Jux stuff, getting into him at Def Jux and then going back through Company Flow. And then I'm going to date myself a little bit here. I'm younger than a lot of people think. I got into Killer Mike through the Kryptonite record, Purple Ribbon All Stars.
I thought you were going to say through Run the Jewels too.
No, not that young. I first got, I remember hearing Kryptonite on the radio, and that was my first entrance to Killer Mike. Even though I was an Outkast fan, I did know about him as this sort of outlier. He was like sort of this big boy hanger on, it seemed, to a young me. And I knew he could rap right off the bat, but curiosity sort of hadn't peaked. And then I sort of started following him through the Pledge series, the Pledge album series that he did. It was like a trilogy of records. I think the third one is sort of the most political of the bunch, where he starts to turn the corner into being the Killer Mike of Run the Jewels. And then I was always more of an LP fan than a Killer Mike fan. And it sort of crossed the threshold for me with Rap Music, the record that LP produced for him through the William Street label, that is sort of overseen by Adult Swim programmer Jason DeMarco. And it sort of all came together for Killer Mike on that record.
And that's fully produced by LP, that record?
Yes, yeah.
We should play something off that record, because I haven't listened to that record in a minute.
Reagan. I think Reagan is the one.
Yeah, let's listen to a little bit of Reagan. And just for context, this is 2012,
yes.
And this is pre-Run the Jewels, but kind of proto-Run the Jewels.
Absolutely.
Reagan off Killer Mike's Rap Music, produced by LP.
The end of the Reagan era. I'm like level 12, old enough to understand this that changed forever. They declared the war on drugs, like a war on terror. But what it really did was let the police terrorize whoever. But mostly black boys, but they would call us and lay us on our belly while they fingers on their triggers. They boots was on our head, they dolls was on our crotches. And they would beat us up if we had diamonds on our watches. And they would take our drugs and monies as they pick our pockets. I guess that's the privilege of policing for some profit. But thanks to Reaganomics, prison turned to profits. Cause free labor.
In 2012, when this record came out, I remember being struck by, I don't want to say the word
fresh for either of its connotations. I don't want to say the word fresh in the 1986 connotation, and I don't want to say fresh in the kind of here's a new thing connotation.
Right.
It was some other iteration of that. It was basically a striking record by two people who'd arrived at a point in their talents where they were not concerned with any broader narrative. Killer Mike was going to make the best Killer Mike record that he could make. LP was going to produce the best Killer Mike record that he could produce, but it did not seem to be really in conversation with a lot of things.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that's sort of interesting about that record is that it seemed like a turning point for both artists in more ways than one. Killer Mike had sort of just gone through the whole major label situation where he was signed to TI through Grand Hustle Records. He was trying to play the game and it didn't work out. And then LP, basically his label went on hiatus. A close friend to him, he lost. I interviewed him earlier this year and he told me that everything that could have gone wrong in his life went wrong at that moment. And this is the late aughts, 2009. And then through this mutual friend at Adult Swim, they are connected. And a lot of people see these two guys as an odd couple. Like, I don't agree with that, but a lot of people see them as an odd couple. And so they meet up at this crossroads moment for both of them. And Killer Mike has said this many times. He said, as soon as LP produced this record for him, he knew they were going to be a group. He said he didn't want to work with anybody else that wasn't LP. And you can't blame him. It was like, you can hear it clicking almost immediately. And LP doesn't rap at all on that record. But that production just brought something out of Killer Mike that we hadn't seen in his earlier records. And he is really, it's really just a whole bunch of things coming together at the perfect moment. Because here's this guy, he has nothing to lose. His producer has nothing to lose. And he is rapping like he's never rapped before. And that's really the crossroads moment for Run the Jewels, because they decide only a few years later that they're just going to go it together the rest of the way.
We should contextualize at this moment LP's production.
Right.
So as someone that kind of was there in a contemporaneous way with the backpack underground of the mid to late 90s in New York, I remember hearing Company Flow for the first time. Probably it was the Indelible MC's record. It was probably the record I heard first. But I remember hearing Company Flow and thinking, and now you have to remember, this is 97, 96, 97.
96, 97.
What's happening in 96, 97 is Biggie, Mace, yeah, Bad Boy.
Yeah.
Major glossy radio New York rap that is beginning what we now understand to be probably the second set of steps towards the full hip-hopification of pop music, sort of following Dr. Dre and The Chronic and whatnot. So all that stuff is happening. And I remember at the time, you really had to make a choice. You had to kind of be like, well, I'm on that team or I'm now on this team, which is right. The Company Flow, Raucous Records. I have two shelves of vinyl still in my home office, which contain any number of strange 12-inch records from that era that may or may not be worth money in Japan on Discogs. I don't know. So that was a choice. And I remember I worked at a magazine called Trace at that time, and we would have these kinds of ideological battles between the two halves of the magazine editorial staff. One half being super, super Bad Boy, like this is the future, and the other half being super Backpack, like this is just not, like they just completely rejected that stuff. Company Flow were, in many ways, the style and sound definer of that counter narrative. And the counter narrative, it's not as if both of these narratives had equal weight in the world. This is like, you know, 100 to 1 in terms of fan base, 1,000 to 1, you know, 100,000 to 1. But Company Flow production is acidic. It's, you know, it's scabrous. It's chaotic. It's, you know, it's like industrial machinery just collapsing on itself. And if you take that run through CoFlow Records into LP solo stuff, into Killer Mike rap music, which is probably like the most buoyant version of it, in my mind, I always thought of that as like one continuous counter narrative, and how strange it would be if that ever intersected with any kind of centrist narrative. That's how I remember feeling at the time.
And that's one of the really interesting thing about Run the Jewels, right, is that they are guys who have sort of existed on the fringes of the rap world. I mean, the concept of underground seems so foreign now to people who have just like the ability to stream all of the history of music on their phones. But that really was such a big thing. This moment in mid to late 90s New York, and those Company Flow Records, they just sound so dark, and his beats are mutating. They sound dystopian and alien and from a different, they sound like they're from a different world than the bad boy that was popping off. They sound like they exist in a different New York.
And also what's interesting is they sound like a different world from the stuff that kind of immediately was happening. Even if you listen to the rest of the Raucous stuff, and Company Flow was briefly Raucous affiliated, but if you listen to the rest of the Raucous stuff, we're talking Black Star, you know, Mos Def solo record, Pharoah Monch solo record.
Absolutely.
You listen to that stuff and you're like, Company Flow makes these guys sound like Bad Boy Records. It makes Mos Def sound like he's on Bad Boy. It makes Khalid sound like he's on Bad Boy. Right. Okay, so let's just for context, just so people get what's happening. Fun Crusher Plus, which is the expanded version of the Fun Crusher EP, which is vinyl only, I believe.
Right.
Fun Crusher Plus does not exist on streaming. I looked earlier today. I don't know if it's samples. I don't know if it's LP not having the rights. It's a very messy thing with this record. He only recently put all the Def Jux stuff onto streaming. I'm sure we'll be able to find this somewhere, if not, you know, in my house. This is the first song on Fun Crusher Plus. This is called Bad Touch Example. Just to get a vibe. You know, get a hard hat. Let's listen to CoFlow.
Yeah, oh, lyrics are fire. Surface bombs from X-Wing fighter stands to B-Boy. Actors fracture. Negative 30 below windshield factor. The counteraction is just a helpless action of the hapless flinching. My supersonics leave you mute like Maggie Simpson. Taxiderm is LP, out of fly translation. Instigated setting quakes throughout your whole situation. Practice exposing perfection like Ricky Lake exposed white trash.
Okay, so now that you've been chiropractically realigned from this Company Flow record, you have a sense of what LP was doing and how there's nods to industrial music. He's a crate digger, but he's digging in different crates. His techniques are familiar, but his reference palettes are unusual. By the time he gets to rap music with Killer Mike, he has smoothed out some of this, kind of maintaining, I think, some texture, but there's a little more bounce, a little more rhythm forward in the later records.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds weird to say they are more understanding of pop music, but there is something that is definitely more accessible about them. And I feel like maybe that's a product of just the stuff that he did in 2004 on High Water, just like the more experimental stuff. Even as he started working on like I'll Sleep When You're Dead, and when he did his own record in 2012, Cancer for Cure, those records seemed to be sort of tinkering with the idea that his music didn't have to be all abrasive, like it didn't have to punish you the entire time. And he is definitely working that. I think maybe part of it in dealing with Killer Mike is sort of trying to, or maybe knowing that a rapper like Killer Mike, whose voice it's just slaps you across the face. It does so much of the work that he doesn't need to be as up in your grill as he was previously. And I really think that in this process of producing, he's produced for other people obviously before, but this sort of idea of stepping outside his purview and producing for somebody that maybe people wouldn't expect him to produce for caused him to sort of rethink what his beats could be and what they can do. And on rap music, they're just a little punchier. They hit a little bit different. And I think it really is the start of this change in sound that allows them to become the group that they become, the one that can chart on the Billboard 200.
Well, and also, you know, this is the thing about Killer Mike as a rapper that's different from LP himself as a rapper when he's producing for himself. Big Juss, you know, when Juss in the company Flow Era. Killer Mike is, he is a dense rapper, but he is an in-the-pocket rapper. And there was something about the lyrical kind of experimentation of the late 90s into the early 2000s that was almost a little bit anti-pocket. It was different from what was happening on the West Coast. The West Coast was like very melodic, had a lot of inherent, there was a lot of almost like breathing exercises within the complex flows. Something that was happening in New York in 97, 98, 99 was kind of like, we're just going to kind of vom all over this stuff. And it was, I think from a production perspective, it didn't encourage space. It didn't encourage room for a rapper to ride, like in a classic sense. And I think by the time we arrive at rap music and eventually, you know, RTJ, the original Run the Jewels record, LP has squeezed some of that old instinct out of his system. You know, we all grow up. I don't write like I used to write for the Village Voice in 2000.
Right.
You know, like we all, those sentences, I look back now and I'm just like, I just, I don't even know what they mean. You know, we all age out of our youthful, impulsive tendencies. But also, Mike is a rapper who, I think if you're in the room with him, you probably want to give him the bounce that works in tandem with his natural vocal patterns.
It's a great point, because in a lot of those 90s records, there's sort of a fidgetiness and an almost anxiousness to the flows. It's a lot of how many words can you pack into the frame type energy. And Killer Mike does have this same technician's approach, but he does like to let the beat breathe, and he will ride a beat.
He's from the South.
Yeah, exactly.
He's from the South. I mean, that's the thing. It's a fundamentally different thing. You know, so much of the music that I imagine inspired Killer Mike from a rapping perspective was probably a little bit slower, a little bit more melodically driven. I haven't gone back and listened to every Killer Mike solo thing in the last like week or so in anticipation of this, but I've got to imagine a lot of his rhyming approach maybe even was like double timing on a slower beat. So that means you have these kinds of spaces and you're kind of chomping at the bit on top of those spaces. So that's probably where some of his understanding of pattern comes from.
Yeah, I think even about the record that comes immediately to mind to me is his one sort of breakout single moment early in his career, the Adidas record. There's not a lot of just like flipping it, dipping it, hipping it, bibbing it, bibbing it, bibbing it.
A lot of that
sort of, you know what I'm saying? It's not a lot of
that. Oh, I know. I know.
There's definitely this sort of groove, find the groove and let that groove carry you type of mentality with him as a Southern rapper for sure. And he carries that into this Run the Jewels era, even as his raps get more and more technical in this sort of sparring match that he has going back and forth with LP on these records.
That's super interesting. I'm so glad you said that. Okay, so let's pivot. Okay, and just a sidebar quickly, I was watching the Ebro and Rosenberg interview with Run the Jewels from the other day, and Mike says how much he dislikes the All Day I Dream About Sex record in a very classic rapper's first sellout single kind of way, reminding me of when I saw De La Soul perform at Wellesley College in 1995. Wow. And they played Me, Myself, and I, and their intro to the song is, we hate this song, we hate this song, we hate this song, which I understand they did at very many concerts over very many years. Anyway, Mike, you're entitled to hate that song, it's all good. But I'm glad you talked about him almost stepping up the intensity. So since we're going chronologically, let's just jump into the first Run the Jewels record, and let's listen to a song on there that I think kind of sets the tone for a lot of what's to come, and that's DDFH.
Pops in the ghetto, they move like the Gestapo. Drunk off their power and greed, they often hostile. My little homie talks shit back and they beat him bad. That boy in the hospital now, he looking bad. And I'm with his mama and dad, we looking sad. My own mama called me, say, baby, I'm Jet Clad. They ain't put their hands
on my child or kill his ass. Please don't rap about that shit before they murder your black ass. It's drones over Brooklyn, your blinky can get tooken. And now you're understanding the definition of Brooklyn. Pigs on parade, but bacon fried and cooking. Cause kids tired of dying and walking around like they shook it. Cause we smoke sour to deal with the paranoia that they charge by.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made. Or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So this Run the Jewels record, and when I went back to listen to it again, holds up way better than I remember. And I'll just own up to that. I remember feeling a little anxiety about Run the Jewels in the early, what year is this, 2013? 2013. I remember feeling a little anxiety about Run the Jewels because, as you know, as a critic, right, you want to be kind of like relentlessly focused on novelty, innovation, forward thinking. And I have always tried to gut check myself against nostalgia and, you know, like that thing where like sometimes I'll talk to people of my generation, which is a little bit older than your generation, and people will just be like, only want to talk about Griselda, you know? And I'm like, yes, I totally understand. Like, Griselda is good, but let us not get confused about that being the center of what's happening right now. There's a whole bunch of other thing that's happening right now. But so I was probably a little overly skeptical of Run the Jewels. And this is just a good lesson for me and hopefully of others to even be skeptical of my skepticism. Because when I went back to this record recently, I was like, this kind of slaps. This is good.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting that you say that because I too, my first impulse when this record was announced was, why not just do rap music too, essentially? Like, it's like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just go back to that well and do that again because it works so well. I wasn't sure how these two would work as MCs sharing space. So often we see two guys rap together and it's just the chemistry is not there. And you can so easily be undone by that lack of chemistry, even when you have two great rappers in sharing space together. I always like to think about this record sort of as the mixtape that precedes their album. It was definitely marketed as their debut album, but this record to me feels like them sort of getting acquainted with one another as partners and sort of working out the kinks. I think it's a great record. Going back, it still holds up. But I still think they're building to this sort of colossal punch that is Run the Jewels 2. And you can hear them sort of feeling each other out. It's like, oh, there's this little dance going on. Like, I don't want to step on his toes. I want him to get the space to breathe. I want the space to breathe. Can I do certain things on these songs that I would do on my own songs? Because even though they do share some broader thematic similarities in their music, they do have very different ways of coming at them.
If you're gonna make a group, right, if it's not gonna be LP producing Killer Mike, if you are a group, what is the ideology of the group? Why does the group exist? Right,
exactly.
And I think if you're 17 with another 17-year-old making that choice, that's a different question. But if you're in your 30s making that choice, there probably should be a reason that you do this thing that makes sense. And part of the reason I wanted to play DDFH is I think part of the reason is in a song like this, which talks about police issues and brutality. You know, it directly engages with the themes that obviously are not new to hip hop, but certainly are not at the forefront of the genre at that particular moment. So I think part of them, as you say, feeling each other out is not just a rhythm thing. It's not just a cadence thing. It's not just a pattern thing. It's a thematic thing. It's what do we have to say that makes sense saying it side by side? And what do we have to say that makes sense when we together say it out to the world? I should also just briefly, I want to shout somebody out because Run the Jewels has been on my mind. And probably if I had not been doing the Pop Smoke story from a couple weeks ago, I probably would have written something about the record, but I just, that week ended up being very, very crazy. But I want to shout out a listener. His name's Juan. He lives in Nashville and he wrote a very long email to the podcast email address. And it got me thinking about this again. It made me realize we had to come back to it for sure. Even though it was on the list, I had to fast track it. So Juan, shouts to you. Thank you for your note. You know, I just
thank
just,
you,
just
Juan.
Be honest. Thanks to Juan. Now, Juan is the reason for me and Sheldon to be on the phone today.
We appreciate you, Juan. Thank you.
Real, real big spit. To circle back here, this is a decision that I don't want to say middle. I don't know what middle age is. I try to be generationally ambiguous myself, I don't know what middle age is exactly. But two men on the lower end of their middle age years making a choice, and this is what they chose. So again, to circle back to when this first came out, to me, this felt a little niche, potentially a little nostalgic. And I'm talking like Bomb Squad era nostalgia, because I think if we're going to locate what LP and his sort of cadre of producers do, it's very much Bomb Squad influenced.
Absolutely.
And it made me, as someone who is also on the younger edge of middle age at that time, think, okay, I'm glad, like I like this, I think. I also am not mistaking this for like Drake, you know, like Drake is what's happening right now.
Right.
This is something that feels this feels like a fringe thing. And it turns out, obviously Drake's very popular, but I was wrong about this being a fringe thing. So just owning up to that.
Yeah, well, it's hard to believe or see this project as novel when there's so much history immediately packed into it, right? Like, here are these guys. It's as you said, like these guys started this project when, let's be fair, a lot of rappers are going out at this age. Like they're investing in this thing at a time when a lot of rappers are done. It's just just the fact of the matter. And so it's hard to be like, oh, this thing is going to work when there's so much riding on you guys sort of rising above not only the expectations of ageism, but also just these massive solo catalogs that you guys have created in different spheres of the rap underground. And so you've got all of these different perceptions looming and you have to fight all of them. And that's really one of the impressive things about Run the Jewels as a unit, is that they took this big gamble and they said, everybody, really, that's a lot of their records are big everybody energy, and they won out on absolutely. That. it's really incredible. And
this is something that we don't talk about enough, I think, vis-a-vis Run the Jewels in the specific moment and arc of their rise, which is, you know, as someone who is paying attention to the ways that the internet was changing distribution methods, letting people with fewer former record business connections break in much more easily, you know, throughout the 2000s into the 2010s, we tend to think of the internet as being a space that is freeing and liberating for the youngest creators. It's basically like, oh, in the 90s, you had to have a friend who had a friend who could pass your tape to somebody who worked somewhere, and you would have to, you know, just kind of really, really struggle at these like kind of small concerts to kind of inch your way towards some kind of notoriety. And And we think of the internet as like, oh, now you can just like have one song and all of a sudden you're the most famous person in America, which is all true. But the internet as a pipeline is not necessarily totally geared towards the young. It's there for everybody. And so Run the Jewels 1 kind of becomes a case study in how internet distribution and awareness can function for a group that is not necessarily trying to reach teenagers. It's trying to reach other middle-aged people who are also on the internet. This is a parallel thing that's happening. It's just something that bears mentioning because I think it's important for us to understand that you and I and critics like us, we're constantly kind of like itching away at SoundCloud or YouTube or whatever, TikTok, just be like, oh, what's a weird small thing that's happening that could become a big thing or could become really interesting. And here's something that's happening basically in plain sight. It's like people are probably downloading this record at their day jobs, you know? And so it's just functioning in a very different way.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting to think about sort of this record is released just on the cusp of like Odd Future Mania. And a lot of people credit that crew with sort of changing the way that people think about using the internet to connect with fans. And I remember being on Twitter at the time and Killer Mike just sort of like tweeting in real time what was going on with the album, him being like, hey, yeah, the album is done. And then they announced that it was going to be released one day. And then a few days before, he gets on Twitter and he's like, no, we're going to release it tomorrow. And then it's released for free and anybody can download it. And it's definitely true that they are connecting with their audience the same way that these young up-and-coming kids who grew up on the internet are connecting with theirs. It is a certain level of savvy that plays into it.
And it's still early. I mean, again, I want to reemphasize, this is 2013. This is not 2020 when every record is free to everybody. Obviously, there are streaming services, but there is something in that era, 2012, 2013, Rap Music, Run the Jewels, first edition, about like, we're going to release it for free. It's like a little bit of a, I don't want to say defeat, but it's like a little bit of a concession. It's like, we're not really like, maybe we can sell this. Maybe we can't sell it. Who can say? It had a little bit of that. It had a little bit of that energy. Not to say that, you know, look, maybe behind the scenes, they're like marketing geniuses and they totally understood it. And they're like, we're going to follow the Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails path. And look, maybe that's all the case. Or maybe it was like, hey, we made this thing. We're going to throw it in the world. Prayers up and see what happens.
I never got the sense that there was a PR machine behind the record. It's like the songs that I was hearing from the record, they were released through blogs. This was like blogs were still a thing. Like, and you're like, you're seeing the singles
R.I.P.
pop
to
up.
Your blog. I don't know who needs to hear this, but R.I.P. to your blog.
And you're seeing singles pop up on blogs. You're downloading directly from blogs, just loose MP3s everywhere. And it was definitely the sense that they were just like the mixtape economy hadn't sort of vanished yet. People were still like going on Datpiff and releasing official mixtapes. And it was definitely this sense that they were sort of tapping in to the old head, like the old hip hashtag hip hop head aspect of that community. They're like, oh, we're just going to release this for three. And whoever needs to hear it, hears it. Like whatever Def Jug's lifer needs to hear it can download it. There was definitely this sort of wait and see approach to releasing it.
Now, we should probably pivot to Run the Jewels 2. Which, again, I gotta be honest, man, I did not know Run the Jewels 2 was Pitchfork's number one album of 2014. I was unaware of that until this exact moment. I did not know.
Yeah.
So I guess it's safe to say that between 2013 and 2014, everybody kind of arrived at the party. Not to say the Pitchfork is late pass, because it's not. But I'm just saying, God forbid me for quoting from a Wikipedia page. Please don't strike me down. But like, there's a section on the Wikipedia page for Run the Jewels 2 that's just year-end lists. Right. AV Club, number 2. Billboard, number 2. Complex, number 1. Yeah. Consequence of Sound, number 2. Pitchfork, 1. Rolling Stone, 1. Spin, 1. Stereo Gum, 1. Vibe, 2. The Wire, 8. So what happened between Run the Jewels 1 and Run the Jewels 2?
They were able to connect with the middle part, the slim shade in the middle part of their Venn diagram. Mm. Over the course of that year, I remember they started doing shows together. They started to appear as a unit. And I think people who initially were skeptical, like you in the initial going, those people were sort of won over in the course of the following months. I do remember the record sort of steadily building steam on the internet, just being out there, and fans sort of anticipating the next record. And the thing about the next record, it is just such a crazy step up from the first record. The production value is higher. It's way punchier. It's like the two of them are in their bag together. They started feeling out the process, and it's like all of a sudden it's like they had a little brainstorm session, and they're like checking off the things that they both agree on and the things that they disagree on. And it's like, all right, everything that we agree on here, we're going to hit this. And then we're going to say F you to all this other stuff that we hate. And it's really just this colossal, like, middle fingers up record. And they just go off in tandem. And I think finally, for a lot of people, it sort of made sense. And this is why I say that these two artists aren't as far off as people like to believe, is because there was always this sort of odd couple narrative going on between the two of them. But it's like, I like to think of them as, there's this meme of like two bodybuilders like clasping hands, one's black, one's white. And it's like this person on, it's like whatever thing on one side, whatever thing on the other side. And then the hands clasping is like the thing that where they meet in the middle. And it's like, so you have LP, sort of this underground impresario at Def Jux, and then you have Killer Mike, this Dungeon Family acolyte and hanger-on. And I feel like the sort of the principles of those two groups aren't as dissimilar as people wanted to believe they were. And so over the course of that year, you're starting to see these two bases converge in shared interest. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, Run the Jewels represents this meeting of the minds, best of both worlds kind of situation.
Wow, that's okay. Well, that's Watch the Throne. This is Watch the Anti-Throne. This is Destroy the Throne. Burn the Throne. This is the Burn the Throne.
Yes.
We should listen to something off of Run the Jewels 2. I'll tell you what we're not going to listen to. We're not going to listen to, not because it's not good, we're not going to listen to Love Again, Akineli Back, which is the record with Gangsta Boo. Not because it's not great. People talking about the baby got sex raps. Run the Jewels was doing, I'm just saying, this is a blush inducing record, but we're not going to listen to that. Let's listen to Oh My Darling Don't Cry off Run the Jewels 2.
Life is hell, and these food bar rulers getting rich. I cop a zip, it opens up, I smoke it up, go home and sell IP girl when they roam. I get a face, please pay with dome. My business card says you're in luck. I do two things, I rap.
Rap, I coach, if I smoke the kush, I beat. If I read the books, did the math. Don't need a preacher preaching on my behalf. No teacher can't teach my arrogance. I'm blowing on privy by reading the scriptures that's written by Egyptians and sipping on whiskey. Hey, baby, you with me?
Oh, my.
Let's speed through Run the Jewels 3, because I do want to get to the current record. You know, Run the Jewels 3 is, to me, it's probably the most, of all the records, including the current one, it's probably the most, I don't necessarily mean this in a positive way, although I do think it's a very good record. It's probably the most ambitious of all the Run the Jewels record. It probably tries the most things.
Yeah, absolutely. That record sort of was recorded under the shadow of Trumpism. It's the Trump empire was looming large. And so I given the sort of nature of Run the Jewels 2, I mean, there's a record, there's a lot of Kill Your Masters energy on Run the Jewels 2 already. And so it seemed like they were given this mandate to be the voice of that moment. And I'm not sure they were quite ready for it. Some of it in retrospect feels a bit forced. Like they weren't sure that they were ready to take on that mantle. It's one thing to be like, tear this down when it's like your own agenda and it's reflecting your immediate politics. It's this other thing when this crowd, this throng of fans is being like, we need you to represent this moment, because then you're speaking for them too. And I feel like under the pressure of under the weight of that, they sort of buckled a little bit. It feels like they're weary from having to bear that mantle. But I do still love that record a lot. It feels like the forgotten record of the three.
I remember listening to Run the Jewels 3 and trying to figure out if what it marked was, I don't know if this is the right term, but if it marked a pivot towards quote unquote maturity, like if it was going to be like, we are going to leave some of the kind of the fritziness of these first two records, we're going to leave that behind, or we're going to kind of temper that some way. You know, it felt like, I mean, look, I don't listen to 1970s rock, so I'm going to mess this up. But, you know, it felt like the kind of like the AOR, the album-oriented rock version of Run the Jewels. And that's not to say that there's not friskiness and punchiness or intensity. It's just, it seemed like it was a little bit bigger and grander in scale. And I think you're right in the sense that even though it's really good on its own terms, I'm not sure it totally plays to their strengths.
Yeah, there's like sort of this slapstick quality of two friends like bantering on the early two Run the Jewels records that is sort of missing from Run the Jewels 3, where they sort of like sit down and they put on their suits and they get serious. It's business time on Run the Jewels 3. And that doesn't really play to their sort of weed-smoking elder statesman energy.
Let's play a fun record off, relatively fun, off of Run the Jewels 3. Let's listen to Call Ticketron.
Run the Jewels live in the garden. Licking our shots and we aim for the darkness. Make it get hot for retarded. Kids cook s'mores off the crotch of our targets. Kumbaya. Buckle up, little trooper. Can't get past me, I'm stuck in the future. They odds cracked up to be the hovercraft cool, but the air's so putrid.
You can tell by the stench in the air. Blood's on the ground, opportunity is here. I'm looking in the space like, is anybody there? And if Ellie isn't here, please tell me how near. Do you come in peace?
So, in retrospect, I think even when Run the Jewels 3 came out, I think I maybe even said, like, this is a step forward. This is a better record than 1 and 2. I don't know that I feel that anymore. I think in the moment, kind of depending what you wanted from them, it could feel that way. But I don't think I feel that anymore. And I think part of that is because of, frankly, Run the Jewels 4, which is very good. So, and it you kind of realize like, oh, the Run the Jewels 4 feels like a little bit of a recalibration post Run the Jewels 3.
Yeah, absolutely.
So talk me through your take on 4.
Yeah, Run the Jewels 4 to me, I talked to LP at the top of the year before I heard the record. And one thing that he kept repeating was that they were trying to meet what they called their EPMD guidelines. They felt like EPMD had released 4 classic records in a row, and each of them sort of got weirder over the course of the run, but over that time they also stayed truest to who they were. And it really does feel like a sort of back to basics record. The fourth go around, they're like getting back to what really makes Run the Jewels work, what makes it interesting, what makes it fun, but also there's this sort of throwback mentality to it, speaking to the classicist in each of them, because they really,
yes,
they're guys that love rap music. Like, they love, woo, rap music. And that's something that you can't say about all rappers. They really do love, they really do love this shit. Like, beyond just rapping, they love listening to it. It's like embedded in their DNA. And so this record feels like an attempt to honor that. It's an homage to the classic records that they love and also what they think that they bring to that sort of storied lineage. And I love the idea of doing like the out of sight record, like getting that mutated, weird, it's funky enough sample and then putting 2 Chainz on it. Like that's such a like bridging the gap kind of moment, where it's like a lot of people see 2 Chainz as this like fun-loving goofball trap artist, but he's been barring out the last 3 years, and he is in their age group and sort of does speak to a lot of the things that they represent as well.
And he's having a bit of a, you know, a social and political awakening himself in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, definitely, with the Rapper Go to the League record.
And this verse on Out of Sight is a very, very good verse. And there are those three songs right near the top of this record that all reference older rap records.
Yeah.
So obviously Ooh La La, which I'm not going to play because it's a little too fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, it samples Greg Nice from Dwick, which is a big Gangstar Nice and Smooth record from the 90s. Go listen to that. It's just a perfect record. It's just a tremendous, perfect record. So then there's Ooh La La, there's Out of Sight. And then the next song, which is, it's called Holy Kalama. Great name. The opening flow is basically a Broken Language flow. Smooth the Hustler, Trigger the Gambler. This is a record where you want to talk about not dating yourself. Let me date myself. This is a record that I used to play on my college radio show off the Profile 12-inch constantly. This was like one of my five kind of go-to records when I was like, I need to like kind of like turn it up a little bit. Like I need the energy. Used to play Broken Language all the time. Could probably still rap 80% of it, you know, unprompted.
That's amazing.
I think my first blog, when there were blogs in the 1.0 old blogs,
oh,
was called
God.
Broken Language. That's how seriously I took that song. So to hear Mike kind of like go in with a little bit of that flow was like very exciting for me, you know, kind of it touched me in a special place. I was very, very,
about nostalgia. Wow. That really
that was very specific for me. And I'm a person, again, that tries to reject nostalgia. But when you're going to hit me this much in my sweet spot, it's hard for me. I'm just putty at that point, you know?
Right.
But I do think it's telling that, like, Dwick is mid-90s. It's Funky Enough is earlier than that. It's early 90s. Broken Language is, like, mid to the end of the mid-90s. Not to be all, like, argumentative about Golden Era, but there's, like, just a specific kind of rap ideologue for whom that is a special time. And it's nice to hear them locate themselves in that tradition, which is obvious. It's just evident from their work always, but to hear them overtly locate themselves in that tradition, but not kind of be beholden to it. And part of the reason I didn't want to play Ooh La La is like, it's a little too beholden to that moment. I think what these other two songs do, and we didn't play any of these, like, let's play Out of Sight just so you can kind of hear the collision of that older approach with their approach. Let's play the part of Out of Sight that kind of goes into the 2 Chainz verse.
You know I'm a product of poverty. I'm cool as AC and you just wanna be. I slide on tracks like home plate, ride beats like road rage, got a crib in like 4 states. I get a text like stay safe, text back. I missed that, be home soon and I can't wait. I came from a dream with some great tape. Assistant went shopping, put my bags in the 8-8. Hello, Mr. Big Safe. The bank teller trying to get ranked. I buy a high.
And then another thing that this record does, and this is later in the record, but like there's the record that has Zach DeLaRocca, who's been on Run the Jewels records before, and Pharrell. And Pharrell, you know, we're out here talking about slave masters posing on your dollar,
right,
over this kind of like you mentioned dystopia before. It's like a dystopian Neptune's beat.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like they basically made a 1.0 Neptune's beat for Pharrell and filtered it kind of through sci-fi.
That song is sort of incredible. It's incredible to think about the dude who was repping Billionaire Boys Club a few decades ago.
Exactly.
Talking that big time anti-capitalist. Like tear down the one percenters.
Yes. But that's like a testament to, I think, not only how effective the message of Run the Jewels is, it's a commentary on our particular political and cultural moment for sure. But it also says that Run the Jewels is successful enough that someone like Pharrell is going to get out of his comfort space and get on a record like this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of funny because you talk about Killer Mike being a Dungeon Family affiliate. The last time I remember him doing something like this was for another Dungeon Family affiliate feature on the Move That Dope record. And it's like he just literally becomes the person that this record needs. And Future at that time was sort of just stepping into his major label, huge pop star moment at that time. And it's sort of interesting to consider Run the Jewels, these guys who have never been that, having enough cachet to get Pharrell to be that same person on their record.
We do not come here to malign Pharrell. Like, right. Pharrell is someone, you know, if you go back to the Skateboard P, you know, the mixtape, the In My Mind mixtape, you know, there's all this stuff with Pharrell rapping where, especially because he was kind of like proximate to the clips, you know, he had layers and variations on his approach. So it's not that it was never there. And it's not that his flexibility was never there, but it is striking. Like, look, it's 2020. Anybody who is paying attention knows what is happening in the country right now. You could choose to tap in and talk about it, or you could choose to not tap in. And I think it's noteworthy that Pharrell makes a choice to tap in here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's telling. We talk about maturity. It's sort of telling of where a lot of people are in this social moment. They're sort of reckoning with a lot of things that they would not have been reckoning with even 4 or 5 years ago. And it sort of speaks to how Run the Jewels are representative of this moment. A lot of the things that Killer Mike and LP have settled on, I think the biggest thematic similarities that they shared going back to the start of Run the Jewels is this idea that you sort of cannot trust your government. The government is like inherently a system built to sort of abuse and misuse you. And that they can get a guy like Pharrell to come on their record and do something like this sort of speaks to the clout that they have built up on this platform. Really, that's what it speaks to. And I think this record is, even in being less explicitly political, I think, than Run the Jewels 3, sort of hits the touch points a little bit harder. Like, I think about Pulling the Pin. I think about A Few Words from the Firing Squad, which that's such an epic closer. It's like not even directly about politics, but it's just two rappers sort of speaking to what is important to them if they were to sort of go out guns blazing. And sort of in that moment of speaking to their loved ones and sort of standing on their platforms, they get deeper into those issues than they did at any point on Run the Jewels 3, I believe.
I'm glad that you arrived at that, because that's actually where I wanted to go out, was A Few Words of the Firing Squad. Especially the part where Killer Mike is rapping about his mother's death. And, you know, when you think of Company Flow, you think of LP Solo, you think of the rap music record, you think of the early Run the Jewels records, you're thinking about anxiety, you're thinking about destruction, you're thinking about bricolage, you're thinking about all these kind of things that feel jagged, right? And the thing that you have to remember about both LP and Killer Mike is these are people with tremendous emotional acuity. And I think what you see on this record in a couple of places, and especially here, is using the structural innovations, the nostalgia-minded structural innovations of Run the Jewels, but honed in on this kind of emotional truth. Because as you say, Run the Jewels 3 is being made in anticipation of the Trump era. And now you have a record that's made fully absorbed in it. And what's striking is, even though they talk about systemic issues, even though they talk about larger structural anti-government stuff, as always, there are moments here that are so keenly focused on the personal. And this Killer Mike verse is, to me, it's a healthy reminder of the emotional intensity that is possible even through these kinds of fractured times and fractured approaches.
Yeah, that framing is everything. It's so much easier to relate to somebody who is speaking from their direct perspective. I think about the record where, or the line in that song where Killer Mike is talking about his wife and sort of feeling her pain. He's like, he, for all these other records, he's sort of standing on his soapbox and preaching to the masses about what is wrong with the evil empire. And then in this song, he steps off and he's like, well, she's like, she does not want to see me die over this, essentially.
Right. She needs a husband, not a Martin or a Malcolm.
Yeah, absolutely. The writing in there is so complex and layered because from that moment, he sort of goes into his history as somebody who grew up in Atlanta. Just riding the MARTA, I remember, is such a keen detail. Just like having an empty 22 in his front pocket in a Brave starter.
In the Braves jacket, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trying to make it out the mud as a baby father is much harder. It's just like these lines about him specifically, the way that this sort of systematic injustice has affected him and those around him, and his fighting it, the way that that has affected the people around him. And that is so much more powerful than a lot of his like opaque statements about sort of killing cops or killing the masters.
To tie this all together, obviously one of the things that has happened in the last 3 or 4 weeks was Killer Mike speaking alongside the mayor of Atlanta. It was sort of at the peak of the unrest. I think it was the day after those two young people were tasered by Atlanta police. Just one of the most horrific of the videoed scenes from the last few weeks. And one of the things that he talks about a lot in that speech is being from Atlanta. Atlanta being very different from being from, say, a city in the north or the northwest or California. A lot of the authority figures, you know, I think Killer Mike's father was a police officer, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, his dad was a cop.
So a lot of the sort of authority figures that people are kind of like pushing back against in his upbringing were also Black. It wasn't a sort of clean, like, white people are the police. That dynamic was not as clean as it may be in other places. And his personal tug of war, the thing that we have to remember, even as turmoil is still kind of gripping the country, everybody is experiencing an individual tug of war premised upon their circumstances. And what I think he does, look, LP is very good on this record. Very, very good. But I think Killer Mike is exceptional on this record for connecting those threads from the global, the spiritual, and the personal, bringing it all back to personal narrative and showing how all of these systemic things shape the personal narrative and how the personal narrative shapes the view on these systemic issues.
Yeah, Killer Mike is definitely doing a lot of the heavy lifting as far as sort of the activism is concerned on this album, and probably throughout the group's career, he's probably done more of the heavy lifting. I think Mike has sort of pushed LP in that direction a little bit, but on this record, you can really hear it. I do think his rapping on his records is always going to be a little bit more radical than his sort of real world politics, which is fine.
Sure.
It's
You mean people are exaggerating on a record?
Yes. Just disclaimer for those who have never heard rap music before. No, sometimes the things saying. They say are not accurate. But yeah, I do think that it's sort of really powerful how he gets deeper into his own, foregrounding his own experience on this record and sort of talking about how the world at large has affected him and his directly and those in his immediate line of sight. It's way less personal to talk generally about the way that the evil empire disenfranchises the masses, even when those things are true. Those are abstract concepts that are hard to sort of wrap the mind around and get invested in emotionally. But when
they're good to kind of like rally a crowd at a show, you know, that they're catchy in a way. But what he's doing right here is a different thing.
Yeah. What's really powerful is how the way that he connects his personal experience to that broader narrative. He doesn't lose sight of that broader narrative. He's just connecting those dots. I mean, at the end of the closing record, he sort of gets into like who he's speaking to. And it's like the do-gooders that the no-gooders abused, and the truth-tellers that were tied to the whipping post, and the strange fruit left hanging from trees. So it's not like he's forgotten about these people and about the annals of history and about all these black bodies that have been left for dead. He's just thinking specifically about his place within that larger narrative. And I think doing that makes this record hit that much harder.
Well, on that note, Sheldon, I appreciate you coming through for this disquisition on the last 20 years of underground rap culture and the bedrock upon which Run the Jewels has been anointed. So let's listen to a few words of the Firing Squad. Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me.
It'd be a lie if I told you that I ever disdain the fortune and fame. But the presence of the pleasure never abstained me from any other pain. When my mother transitioned to another plane, I was sitting on a plane, telling her to hold on, and she tried hard, but she just couldn't hang. Been 2 years, true fears, I'd probably never be the same. This is just a chore not to let myself go insane. It's crippling, make you wanna lean on a cup.
Before we go, just an abbreviated JC Cribs. And we talk a lot about history on podcast and the importance of preservation of history and kind of seeking things out, not just absorbing kind of what's been processed through the internet and kind of force fed down social media pipelines, but of actively seeking something, something that I bought recently. It's like, it's mildly embarrassing. I'm just going to it's just mildly embarrassing, but it brings a smile to my face when I look at it. I'm a big fan of the show American Pickers, which is on the History Channel. Mike and Frank, Robbie and Danielle. If you know, you know. I'm a big fan of American Pickers. Obviously, sometimes I'm watching the show and I don't really understand, you know, the thing that they dig up or why it has value. But it reminds me of an impulse that I myself have and that many of my friends have, and is actually going to be the subject of a subsequent episode of podcast, hopefully later this summer. But that impulse to unearth. And what I have is a American Pickers Mike Wolfe bobblehead. There are other bobbleheads here. I'm not a huge bobblehead collector. But there are other bobbleheads here. I might have mentioned there's a Mac Dre one, there's a Paul Wall one, there's a Chingo Bling one. But I have a Mike Wolfe American Pickers bobblehead. Important. I don't have the Frank. Hopefully I'll get a Frank one soon. Just like a good reminder to keep seeking things out, even if it's a little bit hard. That's our show. Thanks to Sheldon for calling in. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Like Juan, get on the Facebook group, get involved in those conversations, chat it up, subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.
I did not see that at all.
We all have dark corners.
That's pretty dark, John.
Oh, I appreciate that.